Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Robert?
I'm doing well. Jasmine, what a week in Kentucky politics it has been.
A lot of stuff has happened. Like, in the middle, I had all kinds of sports going on, football still going on, basketball just started, and then, like, all of this political stuff all happened, too. Yeah. It was a lot.
Yeah, and a lot of it was happening during sports.
Right. There was a press conference in the middle of the UK game.
Yeah. It was, favored U of L fans because, I guess, the football team had a bye this week. There's all kinds of stuff going on. We're going to talk about two different sexual harassment scandals. We're going to talk about some shady stuff going on in the Secretary of State's office, and we're going to be talking about Rand Paul's really rough week. I think, physically speaking, he may have had the roughest week. I don't know about, emotionally, but...
Right, it's hard to tell, really.
Right, but without any further ado, let's go ahead and start with the fall of Jeff Hoover. All right, Jasmine. On November 1st, the day that we last recorded, the Courier-Journal reported that Speaker Jeff Hoover had secretly settled a sexual harassment claim against him. The Courier was made aware of the settlement by being leaked copies of text messages that had gone between him and another person. These messages also found their way to a Twitter account at Speaker J. Hoover, so we all kind of got the chance to see them. The text appeared to be sexual banter between, this unknown person and Jeff Hoover. I don't know if I should say it, goes both ways, because it does seem like, they're both kind of into it as they're texting back and forth, but we don't really know anything about these text messages. We only have the four or five that are in front of us. The Courier does report that, quote, the woman engaged in the suggestive text exchanges initially because another legislative staffer told her she needed to keep Hoover happy in order to advance her career. After reevaluating the nature of the relationship, the woman came to believe it was harassment and created a hostile work environment, unquote. Okay, so after this all came out, Speaker Hoover was widely denounced by Democrats, which is, to be expected. Mary Lou Marzian, the representative from Louisville, she said to the Courier that, quote, the culture up there is an attitude towards women that is very condescending. They openly objectify women, unquote. So, the Democrats were all very much up in arms. On November 3rd, it appeared that the GOP, in opposition to the Democrats, were going to rally around Hoover. So this was 2 days after it broke. After a meeting of their caucus, the majority leader, Jonathan Schell, young guy, he said, quote, right now, Jeff Hoover is the Speaker of the House and has the full support of the caucus, unquote. That ended up being quite the key, quote, full support of the caucus. Hoover didn't speak that night, but it was made clear by then that he had no intentions to resign as Speaker. That very night, though, cracks began to emerge when Representative C. Wesley Morgan said that Schell's comments, quote, did not reflect the consensus of the caucus. So
Wesley Morgan, that is representative from Richmond, Kentucky, correct?
Yes.
And he is also known for maybe getting some bills passed that favored his own personal life.
Yes, so he plays a large role and a continuing role in this story. So, yes, we do need to make that note. So, C. Wesley Morgan has drawn significant criticism during his first term as a representative for filing bills, which essentially would have bailed him out of a tax problem that he was already in. And also, he's the person that filed a bill that would have decriminalized hitting protesters with cars.
That's correct.
I've called him an imperfect messenger in the midst of all this. So, yes, that's Representative Morgan. But we're on November the 3rd. It looked like everybody's rallying around Hoover. But things got extra crazy the next day, November the 4th. On November the 4th, it was discovered that three more GOP House members were also involved in the sexual harassment case that the Courier broke the news about. Representative Morgan went off on Twitter that day. He alleged that there had been threats of firing and physical violence against whistleblowers, and he said that those constituted violations of the Hobbs Act.
Oh, wow. And yeah. So the Hobbs Act being the federal statute about extortion,
yes,
basically.
Exactly, yeah. And it basically saying, you'll lose your job if you go forward with these kinds of things, which constitutes extortion, I guess. Okay, this all led to Governor Bevin calling for the resignations of, quote, lawmakers trying to hide sexual harassment. And that happened at 4 p.m. on November the 4th, which was right after kickoff of the Kentucky game. The governor said, quote, these alleged actions, which haven't been denied, are reprehensible, indefensible, and unacceptable. Any elected official or state employee who has settled a sexual harassment claim should resign immediately. The people of Kentucky deserve better, unquote. Very, very harsh words from the governor directed directly at people in his own party.
Right. And I think he came out strong on that. Like, that's something that a lot of people want to hear, because oftentimes these things seem to be kind of shuffled under the rug. And so he came out very strong against sexual harassment.
Right.
Or at least perpetuated.
Yeah. You know, this that. Is it's interesting to think about this. And this is something that's been bandied about significantly over the past week. This is a very harsh statement against Speaker Hoover, but also against sexual harassment. And a lot of people, you know, say, oh, this is a great statement by the governor. And other people will say, hey, this is just the governor playing politics. And a lot of people point to the fact that, you know, the president, President Trump, had a lot of sexual harassment problems during his
right.
election
so
last year. And at no point did Governor Bevin denounce him. Of course, Governor Bevin's not really all that close to the president. You know, Kentucky really wasn't a battleground state or anything. Not a lot of Kentucky politicians were involved in the presidential election. So maybe that had something to do with the fact that the governor didn't come and say anything about this. And also, it did appear that the speaker was posing a little bit of a political problem for the governor, because he was, and it's been reported, you know, obviously we weren't privy to a lot of the discussions, but the speaker, whose wife is a teacher, was holding the governor back from doing a lot of the things he wanted to do with the pension bill.
And Jeff Hoover was maybe one of the more diplomatic people in the state legislature. And if there was a Republican in leadership, I think Democrats were satisfied that it was him, because he's diplomatic, mm-hmm. works with the other side.
Or at least purported to. That's right.
Right. And so I don't really know what the relationship between Governor Bevin and Jeff Hoover was like. He didn't seem like the kind of speaker who was like a mouthpiece for Bevin.
Yeah.
And he definitely spoke out against the pension bill.
Yeah. And where I come down on this specific action by the governor is, you know, you can really only take things at face value. And it is a good thing.
And at face value, it's a good thing
to speak out against sexual harassment. Yeah, when it will probably inconvenience him. So good for the governor. This is, I think, a good statement to make. Okay, so that was on November the 4th that the governor made that statement. Later on that day, GOP leaders in the House, without Jeff Hoover, announced the launch of what they call an independent investigation because of the allegations and rumors swirling in the media and the Capitol. So they said this was all going to happen, but no formal guidelines were released. The GOP leaders said that an outside law firm would be conducting the investigation, and that they were working with LRC to give that group subpoena power. They also removed the other implicated House members from their committee chairmanships, at least temporarily. And also, as a side note here, several days later, it was also announced that the FBI was going to be investigating some of these claims that C. Wesley Morgan brought to the fore regarding the Hobbs Act. So the FBI is now involved in the situation. So as late as 8 p.m., on November the 4th, so after the governor said his thing, and after the GOP leaders announced that they were going to start this investigation, Jeff Hoover stated that he had no intentions to resign his speakership, and he said he was disappointed in Matt Bevin's press conference. His quote was, "One must wonder why he is so motivated to attack us unless his goal is to remove a voice that dares on occasion to disagree with him, as I have done when he has made unnecessary statements attacking our teachers, state workers, and retirees who are simply looking for better solutions to very serious problems facing our state," unquote. Hoover also decried the governor for not receiving a courtesy call before what he called his grandstanding. So it looks like the speaker was accusing the governor of playing politics with his statement. But, you know, who knows? We certainly don't. Okay, the next day, November the 5th, Jeff Hoover resigned as House Speaker. So his statement didn't hold up for very long. He did indeed resign his speakership. He will retain his House seat. And the key quote from his press conference when he resigned his speakership was, quote, "I did make mistakes in that I engaged in inappropriate text messages. I engaged in a banter that was consensual, and for that, I am truly sorry. But as inappropriate as these text messages were, I was to reiterate that at no time did I engage in unwelcome or unwanted conduct of any kind. And at no time were there ever any sexual relations," unquote.
"I engaged in banter that was consensual, and for that, I'm truly sorry." That doesn't really sound like a real apology to me.
And it's one of those situations. Okay. And you know, this is a good time to have this discussion. So it doesn't seem like he feels like he's done anything
wrong,
really wrong. And I think this gets to a question of education and a question of just understanding what's appropriate and inappropriate in the workplace.
Right.
You know, we don't know the full extent of the text messages that went between these two individuals. The ones that we have seen did indeed appear to go both ways. It seemed like, you know, she was responding in a flirtatious manner, he was responding in a flirtatious manner. We don't really know what's going on. But even if those were the only things that happened, even if it was just banter between two people that appeared to be consensual, because of who he is, the Speaker
right,
of the House and her boss,
there's
that
a
is,
power
that is inappropriate
at play
and wrong.
Here.
And that is something that should cause you to lose your speakership and should cause you to apologize for something that you've done that was wrong.
Right. I don't think we can talk about something being consensual without talking about the power
yes.
part of it.
Right.
And I think that's what he's missing.
Right. That this is inappropriate conversations to be having between a you know, and if you want to pursue something with somebody who you work in the workplace with, there are probably ways to go about it. You know, Speaker Hoover is married with three children, so, you know, this is probably a situation he needed to extricate himself from in the first place. But, you know, this is something that's inappropriate to have happen. You know, he did something really, really bad. That's just what it is. Okay, now, David Osborne, Speaker pro tempore, is now the Speaker of the House. It's too early to tell if this will have any impact at all on the pension bill or on the budget that's coming up next year, but it's pretty clear that it will on some level.
I don't know anything about David Osborne, so why do we think that it's clear that it will impact it?
I don't think necessarily David Osborne's going to be necessarily the person that impacts it. You know, David Osborne was already a person in GOP leadership, which, you know, means that he was an amigo of Jeff Hoover, who is now, you know, in a lot of trouble. So whatever the legislature had been cooking before and their opposition to the governor's plan still is in place. It's not like the Speaker is now a Bevin loyalist. It does appear that a lot of the people who it seems like Jeff Hoover isn't going to hold back his distaste for what the governor's done. I think that he's going to hold on to some animosity towards the governor for this, and I think that that's going to cause him to want to, you know, he's staying in the House, and even if he's not in leadership, he certainly carries a lot of influence, I think, with some of these people who may see this turn of events as less, you know, less bad than other people, than, you know, what actually happened. I mean, I think that there are people who are going to say, I don't really think you did anything all that wrong, and you're in trouble for it, and I don't agree with the way that things went down. I see that happening.
Okay.
I don't know. I hope that doesn't happen, but I think that it's going to certainly impact the pension bill on some level. What a turn of events. Jeff Hoover was in the House for 30-something years in the minority for all but one of them. This was what his life was going towards accomplishing, was the Republicans winning the House of Representatives and becoming the Speaker. He achieved that goal 30 years plus after getting into the House and lost it.
And it all happened so quickly. This happened from November 1st to November 5th.
Yeah.
With on November 4th saying he had no plans to resign and then immediately resigning less than 24 hours later. So this happened really fast over the weekend.
Yeah.
And yeah.
This is not the first sexual harassment scandal to rock Frankfurt. Back in 2013, a Democratic representative named John Arnold was found guilty by the LRC Ethics Commission of violating the state's ethics code in relation to a sexual harassment claim. This caused a very substantial shift in how the LRC handles sexual harassment charges, but only for nonpartisan staff. The woman who worked for Representative Hoover was partisan staff, so would not have been covered by some of these changes in policy. During this whole saga in 2013, Jeff Hoover was one of the main people speaking out about, like, who knew what, when, and where. And this all turned right back around and hit him right where he is. It's something that I think that there just isn't. I don't know. I don't know if more education would have helped this situation, but it certainly seems like it wasn't there.
Right.
The scandal resulted in lawmakers being, this last scandal resulted in lawmakers being required to spend 3 hours of mandatory time on ethics training and sexual harassment in the workplace training. And during the last legislative session, there was a bill filed by Senator John Schnickel to reduce that to 30 minutes. So from 3 hours to 30 minutes. He called the training, quote, and exercise in political correctness, which just goes to, I mean, I don't think that he has an opinion that is uncommon across trainings about sexual harassment in most workplaces. We may not call them an exercise in political correctness, but they're pretty perfunctory. A lot of times you're just watching videos online, and it doesn't seem like they're given a strong priority.
Right.
This is a problem that's really rocked, you know, the country in many areas over the past, you know, several months. It doesn't seem like people have taken this problem seriously, and time will tell if that changes. It's a really, really bad situation for everybody. The victim in this case, first and foremost, but then also, you know, this is a tragic fall of Jeff Hoover. Not good for him either. And I really hope that the legislature takes some steps to address this issue in the next session, and it does appear that they will. But that's the fall of Jeff Hoover, Jasmine.
And now we are going to continue to talk about sexual harassment in the Dan Johnson saga. So I think it's clear to point out we're not talking about the state representative Dan Johnson, the one from Bullitt County who posted some racist memes on Facebook during the election. We are talking about Dan Johnson, Louisville Metro City Councilman. So maybe less known than the other one, but this has been a huge story in Louisville. And it's just important as a statewide topic because of what's going on in the House.
Right.
And because sexual harassment is bad.
Yeah. This is a saga. This is something we haven't talked about on the show before, even though it's been a story for months and months. There is a little bit of like state level drama that's happening
right
in this particular story, but also like it just seemed relevant.
Right. And it also seems to be a saga that is never ending. So Dan Johnson is a Democrat and Louisville's longest serving city official. Let's start with the timeline of how this all happened. Back in June, Councilwoman Jessica Green accused Dan Johnson of sexual harassment, stating that he grabbed her butt and squeezed it during a group photo and then kind of laughed about it later. First, he came out and said it was an accident, and then he sent out a tweet that he later deleted saying that Green harassed him first by nestling up against him for the picture. Mm-hmm. So that's how this all started. And then he was also accused of exposing his own butt to a legislative aide of Angela Leet and sexually harassing an employee of Greater Louisville Incorporated as well. So there are kind of three main accusations here. Dan Johnson did not want to resign from his seat, but he did come out and say that he was not going to seek re-election, and he would do some counseling. It turns out that city council members are not covered by city human resources guidelines. So on June 16th, Green and Leet announced that they would be drafting sexual harassment policies that would cover city council members. So this is kind of like with the Jeff Hoover thing. There was this policy, but
it didn't cover the people,
nonpartisan
who, yeah.
Mm-hmm. members. On June 20th, Dan Johnson's attorney threatens legal action against Angela Leet and Jessica Green for making the allegations. But also that same day, Dan Johnson made public apologies to both of them.
So, Jasmine, I have to ask you this question. The lawyer in this whole story has been kind of weirdly central to the whole thing. Is this guy like just as bad as he seems?
Right. And we're going to get to him a little bit, but it's almost like I could do a whole segment on his lawyer, but that would take up a whole lot of time.
Right, right.
Because really this story is about Dan Johnson, but you're right that his lawyer is pretty central to a lot of the things that are going on. So that was on June 20th. On June 29th, Johnson left the Democratic caucus, but he didn't resign from the council. Some time goes by. In August, five Metro Council members formed a charging committee seeking to remove him from his city council position. So aside from the harassment allegations, the formal charging document also included failing to vet his former aide, who ended up being fired for mismanagement and using racial slurs.
Nice.
And another allegation of making a comment about his inability to remember events, making him less accountable for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it also claimed that he had a theft by deception charge in Madison County, I believe, and that hadn't been made public before. We have this charging committee and a formal charging document now. A pretrial hearing was held in October where several pretrial motions were heard, one being about the number of votes needed for removal. So there's a state statute about this, and there was a small change in the language of the statute that was previously two-thirds of the sitting council, but now reads as two-thirds of the entire council. So this was a change in the language from the last legislative session. So Dan Johnson's attorney, his name is Thomas McAdam, like I said, more on him later, argued that 18 votes were needed. So the issue was whether the charging committee would be included or excluded, or how many votes would be needed, 14 or 18.
Right.
City Council President David Yates, in that pretrial hearing, ruled that only 14 votes were needed and that any other ruling would be absurd. So he cited how that same statute now appears to make it impossible to remove the mayor from office. So if 18 votes are needed to remove a mayor and a charging committee has to have 10 members, that means that the council court would be made up of less members than the number of votes needed. So that just doesn't make sense.
Right. And the idea here is that these are both state statutes that constitute these rules, and the city itself doesn't have the ability to even change this situation, right?
Right. There's definitely a legal issue of how many votes were needed, but David Yates ruled that only 14 were needed and that Johnson and the charging committee would not be able to vote.
Right.
Also, during this same pretrial motion hearing, there were motions to enter some photographs into evidence, a motion to disqualify David Yates, which was not granted, a motion to subpoena 19 witnesses, including Philip Bailey of the Courier, who has been reporting on Dan Johnson from the beginning
right.
of this story.
Right. This has been.
McAdam, Dan Johnson's attorney, said that if Philip Bailey did not produce information about his communication with witnesses and anonymous sources, he would be asking for him to be held in contempt and incarcerated until he talked.
Right.
So that's pretty severe. McAdam also threatened to sue the Courier if they did not pull three articles that Philip Bailey had published about Johnson. Council President Yates did not grant the request to subpoena Philip Bailey. He did grant requests to admit certain photos and subpoena 14 different witnesses, but he did not grant all 19 that Dan Johnson's attorney wanted to.
Right.
So prior to the trial, a mediation occurred and a settlement was offered. Under this deal, Dan Johnson would not be removed if he admitted to transgressions and wrongdoing and agrees that there's enough evidence to remove him. The deal would also prohibit him from being in City Hall except for 20 minutes before and 10 minutes after any meeting. He couldn't have contact with any council member or staffer except by phone or email. He would not attend any ceremonial functions representing the council, and he would be subject to immediate removal if a 3-member panel determines he violated the letter or spirit of the settlement.
And he would be up for election next year anyway, right?
Right.
Right.
A lot of members of the charging committee were unhappy that a settlement was even offered in the first place.
Uh-huh.
This was offered. Dan Johnson didn't say if he was going to accept it the day it was offered. So then we get to the day before trial. Johnson told reporters that the county attorney's office was paying McAdam to represent him. So this means that the city is paying the legal cost of all of this, despite a rule adopted by the council 6 years ago that council members had the right to be represented by private counsel at removal proceedings at their own expense.
Right. So that would be, if he was indeed getting paid by the county attorney's office, that would be against that statute. But is there, besides Dan Johnson saying that himself, is there any...
I don't know that that comes from a statute. I think it comes from like a council
right.
rule.
Not a, yeah, right.
That
right,
was
right.
adopted.
Not a statute.
But
a
I think
right.
maybe McAdam confirmed that, saying that he was giving the county attorney's office a discounted rate that they were paying him.
Uh-huh.
So that's a whole other part of the story, that the city may be paying for this.
Jesus.
I'm not really sure. But going back to Mr. McAdam, Dan Johnson's attorney, so he was posting things on Facebook about how female attorneys are stupid just days before the trial. And this is a pretty consistent thing that he posts Facebook memes and tweets about female attorneys and how they're idiots.
Yeah, it was all pretty bad.
And it was really bad. And so reporters reached out to Dan Johnson about it, and he's like, guys, it's just like a cartoon.
He said he couldn't even see it. He was like, oh, it's not on there. Right. Like, and a friend of the show, Joe Sanko, was like, yeah, no, here.
No, I'm looking at it. I'm looking right at now. Here it is.
Yeah.
And then he said, it's just a cartoon.
Right.
So it seems that he has an attorney who also maybe doesn't have the best regard for women.
Right.
He's also posted some racist garbage about Attica Scott in the past when she was a member of the Metro Council. And he's just very open about his beliefs that women are stupid. And it's all public.
It was really crazy. Like, I mean, it's, I don't know, maybe this is, you know, you can really tell a lot about people by the memes that they post. But also, like, I think that there's this idea that, you just posted a cartoon. Like, it's not, like, even Dan Johnson's like, it's just a cartoon. But Mr. McAdams is quoted as saying, no, I'm on record thinking women are stupid.
Right.
Like, what? How? Ugh. I don't know. That's just insane to me.
So that is the attorney that a man with a sexual harassment claim has hired to represent him. So, yeah, that's Thomas McAdam. So we get to November 1st. That's the day of the removal trial, and a motion to censure was made. Censure is basically less severe than removal or expulsion. It's basically like a formal disapproval. So Johnson's attorney said that if censured, they would agree to a stipulation that would mirror the plea deal that was offered. So the council voted on the motion for censure, and they voted 13-6 for censure, and Johnson was able to keep his seat.
So this was not to remove, and 13 people, which included 9 Democrats and 4 Republicans, said,
right,
you know, we are voting to not remove him from office, just to censure him.
This divide in votes wasn't really a party lines thing. It was 9 Democrats and 4 Republicans, but the 6 no votes that did not want to accept the agreement were 3 Republicans, 3 Democrats.
And that's not the whole council, because that doesn't include the 5 people on
the charging committee.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so it was basically a settlement that looked like the one that I described before. There was an additional provision in the settlement that includes that Dan Johnson cannot intentionally or accidentally expose his genitals or his buttocks.
Yeah.
So that, I don't know.
I guess
that's a little sad that has to be part of your
settlement. But a good idea.
But a good idea, because it seems like that was a problem with him exposing himself. The censure decision was met with a lot of outrage from the community and from all sides of the political spectrum.
Right. And I think, you know, there was some defense that the council tried to put up, which was basically to say that, you know, they couldn't have voted to remove because of the statute confusion.
Right. And I think that's why this is so difficult, because that is a true issue.
Right.
If they had voted for removal, Dan Johnson would have certainly appealed to Jefferson Circuit Court. And while the appeal is pending, he probably remains on the council. So he probably remains on the council anyways, without any kind of terms put in place to.
Right.
Keep him from exposing himself.
And if this wouldn't have come to trial for at least a little while, and he would have been out by then
if he's not seeking re-election, which
right.
he said he's not.
Yeah.
So that's a real issue. I could see why the people that voted for censure made that vote.
But at the same time, like,
you it's sexual harassment, and people are mad that the council's kind of let this go and said, this guy who sexually harassed at least 2 or 3 people, you're just letting him remain on the council.
Right.
So it's definitely a really complicated issue.
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that before, that even if he had sued the censure, like, there would have been no limits on what he'd have been able to do.
Right. Because there wouldn't be any kind of agreement put in place. So the council that voted for censure believed it would be better to have some terms that he has to abide by than just let him remain on the council during appeal, because of this weird legal issue with the change in the language of the statute, which is a real issue that, if it's not getting appealed now, it may sometime in the future.
So we thought that was going to be the end of it when we started writing this story. Are you?
We did. So this happened last Wednesday. Fast forward to Monday, less than a week, and Dan Johnson is already facing removal for violating the terms of his agreement. So a 3-member panel is supposed to hear the complaint filed by Angela Lee that Johnson was in City Hall well after the agreed upon time limit. So If you'll remember from the agreement, he cannot stay past 10 minutes after a meeting. And I believe the day of when the trial was supposed to start, she said he was there 28 minutes later.
Yeah, he said he was waiting for his wife to pick him up.
Right. And so there was a second complaint that was made by Bill Hollander, who's my city councilman, in an email that Johnson's Facebook post following the trial violated the spirit of the settlement and contradict the admission to transgression and wrongdoing. So I think he made a Facebook post saying that he won his battle with the city council, and he was supposed to be admitting to his wrongdoings. And so Councilman Bill Hollander said he's already violated the spirit of that settlement by posting things like that. Maybe there's a First Amendment issue there too.
Right,
I don't know.
Right, right, right.
Johnson says that the council is misreading the agreement and he will appeal any decision to remove him. So on Monday, this 3-person panel met with no public notice, which is required by Kentucky open meetings. We're always talking about open meetings and open records on this show.
Right.
The panel and an assistant county attorney admitted that notice should have been given, so then they rescheduled a special meeting for Tuesday. On Tuesday, they punted, citing that they're trying to make sure that the panel was set up correctly, legally speaking. So there's also maybe a legal issue with how the 3-person removal panel is set up and whether they can do that. So now that's another thing that they're working with the county attorneys to figure out if they've went the proper route with this. So now the meeting is scheduled for next Monday, but there is a council meeting tomorrow, which is Thursday, and there is a Me Too rally planned to protest the decision to keep Dan Johnson on the council. So the council may be met with a couple hundred people rallying tomorrow.
We will see.
And so finally, this has been going on since June, and just recently Mayor Fisher made a statement that said basically nothing and didn't even mention Dan Johnson. Basically talked about that he's had a record of supporting and promoting women and that harassment is not acceptable, and that's about all he said.
Right.
So Joe Girth wrote a piece in the Courier this week kind of about like Bevin coming out so much stronger than Mayor Fisher did about harassment claims. It's kind of about perception. We know that Mayor Fisher is probably against sexual harassment and has a record of doing things that are probably against that. But Bevin just came out much stronger, whether he actually feels stronger about that, but he voted for Trump, you know.
Right.
But it's about the perception, and he came out strong against it, and Mayor Fisher didn't really say much about
it. Yeah, I don't really understand the political move to like not condemn Dan Johnson strongly. Like, I don't understand like what the fear is, like why Mayor Fisher would be like not doing that. I mean it doesn't seem like it makes sense politically, not to even speak about like how morally it's the right thing to do. So yeah, that has been a very confusing thing for me. But you know, I think when you put this statement side by side, it certainly is the case that Governor Bevins was much, much stronger.
So. Right. And so that is where we are with the Dan Johnson saga.
We are not done yet.
But
though.
We're not done yet.
Yeah. So tell us about Rand Paul.
All right. Rand Paul had a very rough weekend.
He's not alone. But
but other people did too, but maybe
he had a rough weekend in a different way.
Physically. So during an already eventful weekend for Kentucky politicians, it comes out that Senator Rand Paul has been assaulted at his Bowling Green home. So when I first heard this, I had to assume that this was like a political thing or that it was a home invasion, his house got broken into. But later, more and more facts start to come out, and the alleged perpetrator is his anesthesiologist neighbor, Renee Boucher.
How do you say it?
I don't know that that's right. I've heard that maybe it's different, but
who knows?
That's what I'm going with. They live in the same gated community, and their properties border one another. So it was reported that Rand Paul was mowing his grass when the assault occurred and that he was tackled. So I guess I have a lot of questions about how this actually happened, what kind of lawnmower he was on. The New York Times said it was a riding mower, and he was getting off the mower when he was tackled. But if he got tackled and his lawnmower keeps going, that's just a weird picture to
me. Well, I mean, it was a pretty substantial injury, right?
Right. And so He suffered six broken ribs.
You don't get six broken ribs by getting just tackled. Like, you get tackled and then you get beat up. Like, I don't know. I don't think that that's just something that happens when you... Like, this seems like a pretty severe altercation.
I don't know. Maybe he's a fragile guy. I'm not sure. And it seemed like there weren't any witnesses who actually saw this happen. So we don't know.
Yeah.
Boucher was arrested, and he was charged with assault in the fourth degree and posted a $7,500 bond. Assault in the fourth degree is a misdemeanor. So a lot of people keep saying things to me like, I can't believe he was only charged with a misdemeanor.
I mean, that seems crazy when you are assaulting a United States senator to get a misdemeanor. But
right. But it does take quite a bit to get to a felony assault. And so the lowest class of felony assault is assault in the third degree, which is pretty simple. That's an assault on a police officer or various state workers. So even if it's the most minor assault, if it's against a police officer, public school teacher, or various other state workers listed in the statute, that makes it a felony assault.
Not, you know, United States senators are not included in that statute. I
think
this
that is a
may
state
change.
Statute.
That may change by in the next session. I feel
so,
like it's coming.
Then there is assault in the second degree. That's a Class C felony, but it requires a serious physical injury or use of a deadly weapon or dangerous instrument. So it could be a minor injury, but a minor injury with a knife or brass knuckles or some kind of dangerous instrument or deadly weapon. That would increase it to an assault in the second degree. The other way for it to be a second degree assault is a serious physical injury, which is actually a pretty high standard. It's not just any injury.
Not even six broken ribs?
To constitute a serious physical injury, there has to be prolonged impairment of health, substantial risk of death, prolonged disfigurement, or prolonged loss or impairment of the function of a bodily organ.
Huh.
So that's actually really hard to get to. If you were trying to prove an assault too with this case, you would kind of have to go under the prolonged impairment of health prong. That's the only way you get there.
Gotcha.
I don't think Grandpa's going to be disfigured or lose the function of a bodily organ or anything like that. So it's kind of tough to say if broken ribs would fall under this definition. If this is an injury that's going to take months and months to heal, and he's not going to be able to fly or work,
right.
Then yeah, maybe it's serious. So serious physical injury is very fact specific.
Mm-hmm.
How long is he going to be injured? How quickly will he heal? When can he go back to work and do normal daily things? So it's kind of hard to actually get to a felony assault in this case. But you could argue that he could have been charged with it, but I think as long as he's going to fully recover, assault in the fourth degree is maybe the more appropriate charge. KSP, Kentucky State Police, originally said that the injuries were minor, so I don't know if they said this before or after it was determined that his ribs were broken, but then they also said that if a prosecutor believes the injuries are deemed severe enough, they may amend the charge to a felony and try to indict him on probably an assault in the second degree.
Gotcha.
Boucher allegedly admitting to tackling him, but details about why are very sparse.
Right. Just back to one step. You know, it does appear that Senator Paul will be, you know, prevented from working for at least a little while. He said he wasn't going to be able to fly, and like Senator McConnell's like, this is going to cause some problems with our tax bill in Washington.
Right. Senator McConnell, very sympathetic.
Right.
Right.
I don't think they're friends. But yeah, I mean, that could go towards that felony.
So that, like, yeah, right. So if he had an assault in the second degree trial, that would be part of the evidence that it was prolonged impairment of health,
right.
That this is how long I can't do these things that I need to do. But it's very fact specific, and serious physical injury is actually a pretty high standard.
Gotcha. Right.
The FBI and Kentucky State Police are involved. Which I guess you got to do that for a U.S. senator. But this really just sounds like maybe a neighbor spat. The lawyer for the defendant said that it was a very trivial matter that led to the dispute. So now there's been all the speculation about what it was over. And a lot of people are saying that it may have been over yard waste. Rand Paul grows pumpkins on his property. He composts.
Good for him.
So some competing theories from neighbors included unraked leaves, some newly planted saplings, and stray yard clippings. One neighbor was quoted in the New York Times and said they just didn't get along and it didn't have anything to do with politics. He said, I think it was just a neighbor-to-neighbor thing. They both just had strong opinions and a little different ones about what property rights mean.
Oh my gosh.
So another neighbor also said that Rand Paul believes in much stronger property rights than what exists in America. So it sounds like maybe this is some kind of land dispute. A friend that visited Rand Paul over the weekend said that the two hadn't spoken in a long time, and Rand Paul still doesn't know why he was attacked.
Jeez. Well, you know, that it is terrible. I mean, this is terrible. Never assault
no,
is bad.
It's bad.
It's very bad. This is the most Rand Paul assault on Rand Paul I can imagine. If it's
over property rights.
And him thinking that he can just do whatever he wants to on his property.
Plant his pumpkins wherever he wants.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, get well soon, Senator Paul. We are still not finished, though. There's one more story to talk about.
This is...
And to be honest,
there's actually even more we could talk about.
Oh, there's so much more on all of these stories.
We have to cut it off at some point.
We do, and we're already way over time, but we're going to keep going because this is something that would have led any of the stories that or any of the shows we've done in the past like month or two if it had happened any other week. But, you know, this week was just crazy. And it's that Allison Lundgren Grimes is involved in some real weird stuff having to do with the State Board of Election. Okay, it was reported on October 25th. That the Kentucky State Board of Elections fired their executive director and the assistant to the director. Assistant to the director is like Dwight Schrute.
Right.
Right?
Assistant to the regional manager.
Right. So these two people, they were fired on a 3-2 vote of the bipartisan board. And the vote was not along party line. So the State Board of Directors is allowed to, you know, make staffing decisions on that level for their staff. And there's six people on the board, and three of them voted to fire these two people. Republicans and Democrats both voted to fire these people. The executive director's name is Mary Ellen Allen, the executive director of the State Board of Elections, and she's a Democrat. And the assistant to the director's name is Matthew Self, and he's a Republican. As soon as this came out, it was immediately alleged that the firings were in response to a complaint that Mr. Self had filed with the executive branch Ethics Commission. His complaint alleged that Secretary of State Allison Lundgren Grimes improperly gathered voter information from the state's voter registration system during the campaign she ran for both Senate and her re-election to the Secretary of State's office. Mr. Self is quoted in the Herald Leader saying, quote, data that is released is documented, recorded, and tracked through every step of the system to ensure that everything was done properly. When the data was taken out of the building on a thumb drive, that trust was broken. We have no way to know what was on it, where it went, or what it was used for, unquote. Statewide candidates are allowed to request voter information from the State Board of Elections. It costs $450 each time, and Mr. Self alleges that Ms. Grimes only paid once. He further alleges that staffers in the Secretary of State's office were given administrative access to the database, which would have been inappropriate. And he said that a $159,000 contract for data security was granted without a vote from the State Board of Elections and against their wishes. The owner of the company that received that contract was a major donor to Ms. Grimes in both her senatorial run and her run for Secretary of State each time. Secretary Grimes, of course, called Mr. Self's allegations politically motivated and spurious. Her office said that voter data is not only available from the State Board of Elections, but also from political parties and third-party vendors. Her office pointed to minutes from the February 21st, 2017 meeting of the State Board of Elections, where they said the board, quote, took appropriate actions to engage with the vendor, unquote. But Mr. Self says that that didn't constitute a vote to authorize a contract. So Secretary Grimes did not address the claim that her staff inappropriately was given access to the voter data, which seems like a big deal. And Ms. Grimes lastly stated that the State Board of Elections voted to terminate these two individuals in a bipartisan manner and that she didn't have a vote. So her defense around this entire situation seems to be that, you know, I have no reason to take this data because I can get it from other places, which, you know, that checks out. That's factually correct. And she said, you know, we did approve this contract, even though the language in the document's kind of weird and funky and maybe not exactly correct. And then she was like, oh, this big thing that my staff was given inappropriate access, I'm not even going to address that. And then, you know, she said the State Board of Elections is a bipartisan board. It exists for this purpose so that people can't just wield political power in this way, and that it worked the way it should. And these bipartisan group of people fired these two people for whatever reason they decided, and I wasn't involved. Jasmine, this feels very Clintonian, don't you think?
It does, and it sounds very ALG.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a lot like Hillary Clinton, because it's like nothing in here really goes to anything that you can prove to be wrongdoing.
Right.
And in fact, it's completely reasonable, and if you're going by evidentiary standards, nothing appears to be wrong. But it feels really funky. And
yeah.
It feels like this is, you know, something's gone wrong here. And so, you know, as somebody who was a supporter of Hillary Clinton in the presidential campaign and before, you know, I'm trying to check myself here and be like, am I assuming bad things about Secretary Grimes, you know, because inappropriately, you know, but it does feel weird.
And throughout her election and everything, she was kind of known for not answering questions and leaving things out, which
right.
is kind of what she's done here. She's not addressing this one big part of what she's being accused of. But you're right. None of this really feels like inherently wrong. I don't know.
Not only inherently wrong, it seems like there's like you know, it would be insane of her to like steal data from. I mean, there's no reason for her to do
right,
that.
Right, because there's so many ways
She could walk right into the Kentucky Democratic Party office and get the exact same data because they have it. And they would give it to her because, you know, she's an elected constitutional officer.
Right.
She doesn't have any reason to do this. Doesn't mean she didn't, but that would be incredibly stupid. And then also this whole contract dispute, it seems like that there's like enough evidence there to quash an ethics complaint. But at the same time, you know, this dude's a massive donor and it just smells weird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. This is something that if Secretary Grimes does want to go on to other offices, this is the type of thing.
This is going
to
be like the emails.
This follows you around everywhere you go. And whatever she runs for in the future, this no matter what happens with the Executive Branch Ethics Commission, this will get brought up. Hey, you remember the time she stole data when she was Secretary of the State?
Absolutely, it will.
And what this is something that can definitely catch fire because people just, you know, have odd thoughts about her generally. It doesn't feel great, but at the same time there's no proof that she did anything wrong. So crazy story, right?
Right.
Jasmine, we don't have any quick hits today because we are already way over time. So Jasmine, tell people how they can get a hold of us.
They can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @myoldkypod. We have a Facebook page that you can like. We post our show notes on Medium, and you can find our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice.
All right. Thank you guys for listening, and we will see you next week.